Welcome to Talking About Organizations. This is the part two of our episode in which we discuss the Connections in Actions event and try to make sense what have we learned and what are our general impressions of this conference that happened at the beginning of the last week. This is Pedro, fresh off the plane in Brasilia in a beautiful summer day.
And this is Brian from rainy Dublin, Ireland, on a dreary night.
And this is Katerina from Zurich, Switzerland, with a very icy, cold, kind of snowy night.
Wow. Good for, like, very Christmassy.
Yes, it is. Yes, yes.
Well, it's very Christmassy here in Dublin, too, but raining. So, anyway. Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we start by, you know, sharing what were our general impressions from the event? What are, like, maybe like some themes or issues that struck us more or less? So how did you guys think making the trip out to Warwick? Was it worth it?
Well,
I think so. Well, you go ahead, Brian.
Well, I think so too. I was so excited. I've been a fan, I guess, of Barbara Czarnowska since I was a graduate student. Her work has inspired me for years. And so I was just extremely pleased to hear her talking about action nets. And of course, Paula Jarzakowski's presentation on the global reinsurance market. And and also Jennifer Howard Granville's presentation about the sort of global impacts and implications. These are just fantastic material, and we had a lot of time to talk. It was just really a great learning experience. No question.
Indeed. I agree. I think I took 12 pages of notes or something. So I tried to keep all the good ideas and insights that I had.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, very productive.
Hey, so Pedro, we were going to go back over our questions that we asked before the workshop, though, right?
Yes.
And see if they got answered. Was that one of our things?
Yes.
I think that's a good goal.
Yeah, yeah. So what was your question?
So my question was building actually in one of your questions, but I had two questions. One was, you know, since we are talking about connections, you know, I tend to have, you know, an interest for methodology. So my point was more, so how do we go about tracing them? You know, we have understood that we want to try to do a more relational kind of social science. So the point is, now, how can we capture them when you do, you know, our field work? And also, how do we retrace or recreate them, you know, when we write? So that was one of the questions that, which was, I think we're building on your question on what is a connection in the first place, right?
Absolutely. It seemed like such a fundamental idea, and it came up over and over again in our discussions. So we can talk about that, you know, during this podcast.
Yes.
So why don't we start with your question, Brian? So what are the insights that we got from the workshop about what are actually the connections we're talking about?
Well, one of the things I noticed, so right at the beginning, I asked this question to the group, and I have to say it was, you know, partly because we had just done the podcast, so I was all pumped up, and I said, oh, here's this question. How can you tell when practices are connected? And, you know, it's kind of a tricky question, right? Because you would normally think about connecting, like, people, or, like, you could say two people are connected if they're friends or if they communicate or something, or you could talk about if two places are connected or if two actions, like if one action leads to another. But when you talk about whether or not two practices are connected, you know, practice is a kind of complicated, ongoing set of activities of, you know, and it's all of those things, you know, in the conversations that we had in the workshop, every, you know, people are all very practice oriented, and processual oriented, relational oriented. And so the idea of understanding how two practices are connected just is, I mean, we raised the question, but I didn't feel that we really got a good set of answers to that.
Okay.
You know, that I felt we could have gone farther.
Yeah, somehow nobody wanted to take the challenge of addressing the question directly. But I think, at least I, for my part, I made a longer list of ways in which practices can be connected, which were mentioned during the workshop. So it's like we didn't explicitly address it at one point in the workshop, but kind of people in talking about the different phenomena that they were studying mentioned different ways of being connected, I guess.
Yeah, and so should we share with our listeners? I mean, the example, this global reinsurance market, was a really good example because it offered a lot of context, you know, for different, just a lot of interesting conversation. So, you know, I think when Paula described it, they started their study by saying, how is reinsurance and the way it's done in London different than the way it's done in the Bermudas? Because those are two important places where this work takes place. And then they quickly realized, or eventually realized, that these are both parts of this global reinsurance that has locations in Tokyo and other places as well. So it was very compelling and interesting example. So then, Katrina, when you were listing, like, what things did you put on your list for ways that things can be, that practices can be connected?
Well, for example, I mean, one thing I think that came up quite often is concepts or labels. So that okay. People put a label like their
social
doing
enterprise.
So they're social entrepreneurs, or these people are doing reinsurance, or so that's, yeah, we put labels or concepts on, or the participants in the fields also, they use the labels, right? They refer to what we're doing is reinsurance.
Or the thing Barbara talked about was quoting. Like making a quote to offer a price, right, for something, seemed to be a very important part of this market.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I think it was Paula that was talking that.
Oh, Paula, sorry. Sorry, I misspoke. Yeah, right. Of course, right.
Yeah. So there is actually this interesting dimension, you know, in which, so if you take the example of labels, they are in part something that the informants or the practitioners or the natives themselves do. So, you know, people in a specific site or field are themselves creating connections, you know, making them visible, accounting for them, saying that, you know, they see this or that connected or part of the same thing or, you know, interdependent. But also there is the issue that, to what extent are we ascribing the connections as, you know, social scientists?
Well, so, I mean, you guys are both there. I mean, so in this Barbara Czarnowska's talk, she talked about implantment and I guess what I would call sort of narrating the data, like taking maybe a jumble of observations and perhaps some interviews or data that you've collected, anyway, field work, and weaving it into a fabric that has some coherence. And so, Pedro, is that what you were thinking of?
Yes. Something along those
lines. Yeah. I mean, that caused a little bit of controversy in the meeting, I think.
I think the way Barbara sees it, that it's both. It's kind of you follow the connections that the participants in enacting the practice make themselves or account for or whatever. But then in addition, as a researcher, you pick certain connections and you put them into a plot, a story. That's what she refers to as implantment. And so in a way, I guess, Pedro, I would say it's both. We're following,
But let me try to play devil's advocate, because one of the problems of that, well, it is, of course, a bit of what the participants do and is a bit what you do, you know, but the issue becomes, you know, so how do you select the connections? You know, if it, there is a strong role of the social scientist or the field worker, because I usually feel that connections are not apparent in themselves. You know, you have to make the cuts or make them visible. You know, they don't present themselves, you know, in a streamlined way. And we can give the examples of more, you know, situations in which the connections are erased as a political act, or they are not erased, but, you know, they are perceived as so once you show the connection. So, for instance, there is this historical sociologist from Warwick that has done this work on the concept of modernity and the Industrial Revolution in England. And she shows that how much that has happened in England and in the West in general depends on many things that were happening in Asia, in particular in India, and how either the raw materials or the fact that, you know, England tried to do a series of not very, I would say, fair practice to put out the textile fabrics in India made the industrial revolution happen. So many times the connections also have a political dimension in which making them, you know, it's powerful and depends on a specific kind of theories and concepts or whatever that you bring, you know, to understand them.
So you're saying that participants can deliberately hide connections. I mean, if it's taboo,
yes,
if it's illegal,
yes,
if
yes,
it's undesirable,
yes,
in some way, sure, absolutely. You know.
Actually, we had this issue in another project, which we were talking about at the poster session. There was, I think it was Wando Albu, who was a little bit frustrated by, so how do I study connections with which I know that are there, or like participants and act them or whatever, but like I can't see them or I can't trace them because
oh, I remember
whatever
that.
Reasons, like people hide it or, you know, mm-hmm, you're maybe not there or I don't. So she had this puzzle of how do I trace connections that are hidden.
Absolutely. But then, so what's the answer? I mean, how do you study something you can't observe?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a tough question, but I think the sad answer may be that you kind of don't study things you can't observe.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, that was my answer, but
yeah, I felt bad.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it's tough. But for the things you can observe, though, I mean, this is what I was on about. I was really pretty pumped up about this because, you know, there's a lot of – so in my own work, I've often talked about interdependence between actions or actors, and one of the things that came up from this recent special issue on organizational routines was, you know, understanding how routines are related and how routines are connected, and you know, you can debate whether routines or practices or, you know, how that vocabulary should be applied, but I think conceptually it's the same kind of issue. And so I came into the workshop really thinking, okay, let's talk about how things are connected. And it was interesting that people seem to want to keep it at a metaphorical level rather than getting concrete about, you know, how you'd know it when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's kind of my, you know, North American bias on this kind of thing is like, Show me how it's connected.
I just want to respond to that issue of, you know, observing the limits of observation. Because I think we had a couple of interesting projects. You know, I think Gianluca Michoni is the one studying Bitcoin, and he says that, you know, it's very hard to trace these things because there is no place to go as a field worker or, you know, social scientist. And he was referring to other people that are studying things like Anonymous, you know, and I think the point is that in some situations there is a bigger toll on the researcher to show the connections, which also can be, you know, if we see that from a positive light, I think it hints on what Jennifer Howard Granville was saying, that, you know, this invitation of why does it matter to make this more, you know, relational, processual, practice-based kind of, you know, theorizing, in which we take up the responsibility of showing how things are connected. You know, how things, I'll go back to the issue of, you know, underdevelopment and development across countries, but it can be of issues of gender and race and discrimination or the wrongdoings that organizations do across the world in the supply chain. You know, so it is a bigger challenge, but also can maybe yield bigger benefits to, you know, our relevance. Just a thought.
And I think it actually connects a little bit to the question that Brian asked, or the issue that Brian pointed out earlier, that at the workshop people kind of didn't really talk about the specifically about the different ways in which things are connected. And I think maybe that also has to do with, like, it's sometimes very different, like the, those things that are like the connections that are consequential, it's actually quite difficult to describe and put in words the ways in which they connect.
Yeah, it could be connected in a lot of different ways. Yeah. I mean, that was really clear in terms of Paula's description of the global reinsurance, but so, so can I come back to Barbara Czarnowska for a moment? Because she gave a, what I thought was just a really helpful description of the of her idea of action networks, action nets. And I think it's helpful because it has this very processual, relational kind of foundation. And it, so, you know, Pedro, when you're talking there about, you know, phenomena that are spread out over time and space, and they may have, I mean, you have a long, you mentioned a long list of kinds of things. You know, from Barbara's point of view, one way of approaching those things is to understand how the actions, bring those phenomena, you know, to life. So if I'm going to stick with this reinsurance example, so how are the actions within the reinsurance market related? What's the action network? You know, there's a quotation here. There's, that's, I guess, a quote means there's an offer to sell something at a certain price, but then someone has to buy it. And, you know, so buying and selling, quoting and pricing go together to make the market. And so the thing that, you know, to sort of answer your questions, how do we trace this? The idea that I find helpful is to think of these things in terms of narrative. You know, so Czarnowska used the term implotment, and we talked about, you know, story, implotment, narrative. You know, these are, I guess they differ in the degree of specificity. You know, if you're filling in the particular actors or just talking about the abstract plot, but the thing that I thought was quite compelling and I thought quite helpful in her talk was the idea of taking this jumble of data and, you know, I think as Katrina was just saying, that participants themselves may see what they're doing, you know, see the threads of action that they're trying to carry out. But we as researchers would still weave those together to tell, to create some kind of a fabric or picture about this practice, you know, and that was kind of helpful to me. And so over the last week, I've been at two other conferences. First at the IFIP 8.2 conference in Dublin. It's the theme was Beyond Interpretivism, and we had Karen Norsatina and Tim Ingold as the keynote speakers. So again, very practice-centered, very relational, very, very socio-material. I mean, very, you know, that's the whole kind of, because Vonda Orlikowski was one of the program chairs. So I've been thinking a lot about this stuff and how to actually carry out that procedure that that Barbara Czarnowska was talking about, this idea of weaving threads into fabric and understanding that better. So it's not just from our meeting at Warwick, but from these subsequent meetings, I've kind of had some new ideas about that.
So well, what are those ideas, Brian? Tell us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now that you make us all curious, you have to tell us.
Well, so I was, so here's the thing. So in Warwick, you know, I showed up with the idea that like, oh, I have an idea of how to compare, how to describe and compare actions of patterns of action. And I have this little software tool that you can download. And, you know, in a way, it's like this. It's like, you know, people who are doing quantitative analysis will take their tables of numbers and put it in SPSS and push a button and get a correlation matrix or a regression. But people that want to do qualitative analysis and then from that qualitative description be able to understand the relationships within a practice in the way that, you know, Charnoska is talking about. So to weave the threads into the network, they don't have any way of doing that. And, you know, for the last, I don't know, 20 years, you know, me and many others have been saying that these action patterns are important, but it's just been a pain in the butt to actually do the work. I mean,
the weaving.
The weaving is not that straightforward. So for like the last year, I've been working on writing software to help do that. So anyway, in Warwick, I said, oh, hey, I've got this software. And it's like nobody was interested because I think they thought it was going to be stinky and bad or something. I don't know what they thought. It's like they didn't want anything to do with that. So what I figured out is I need to describe it a different way. So here's my new thing. I'm going to talk about the poetry of practice.
Oh.
What do you think? Does that sound good?
Yes.
Better? Poetry. So poetry. Ideas like, you know, repetition and rhythm and rhyme and alliteration and, you know, other, and there's poetry, of course, has dozens of helpful concepts, but, and you have to be careful when you're translating from one domain to another. And of course, now we're mixing the metaphor of, you know, how is a fabric like a poem and how is a poem like a practice? And, you know, it gets, you know, this is just kind of preliminary, but the thing that struck me, if we think again about the kinds of things that we're talking about in the workshop, so global reinsurance, you know, how mm-hmm. is the practice in London like the practice in the Bahamas? Well, let's think about repetition. What do they do? Well, they do quotes. They quote, they offer quotes, so there's things that they repeat, and they do them in a similar rhythm, a similar kind of meter, and you might find similarities there. And you can ask. And the one that I really like though is this idea of rhyming, because. So, and I'm not going to do a good job of explaining this, but so two things we know about actions, right? First of all, actions are situated, right? Mm-hmm. Actions occur in a time and a place with people and things and material. So situatedness is a crucial part of understanding what's going on in action. And the other thing we know about actions is they don't happen in isolation, right? One action goes with the next, with the next, with the next, which is, you know, Barbara's point about them being threaded and occurring in networks, right? They're not, like a musician doesn't just play one note, you know, you play a phrase. So they're situated and they're threaded. And with those two things together, what could it mean for practices to rhyme? And at first I thought, oh, this doesn't make any sense. You know, rhyming, how could that be? But so if you have a phrase, like in the reinsurance market, a common phrase is to offer a quote. Well, what would it be like if two quotes are rhyming? But might mean that the quotes are done in a similar way, perhaps by the same people, perhaps in a similar place, with similar tools, and mm-hmm. the accumulation of tools, people, place, and other things. The more those things match, the more those practices are rhyming. Someone here in Dublin pointed out to me that rhyming is a way that is a tool we use to memorize. It's an aid for memory. which, you know, when they said that, I said, oh my God, you know, so if these practices are rhyming, there's more memory connecting there, you know, they're more, more likely to be ruts in the road, to borrow, you know, one of the routines metaphors. And so, I just, you know, have this intuition that we can borrow some ideas from, you know, poetics and use them to help understand the way that practices may be connected, even in the situation where there's not necessarily a flow like this, you know, obvious flow of materials or people, or, you know, they could be connected just because they rhyme.
I very much like this idea, and I think the reason why I like it is that it has this aesthetic element to it that it allows us to get, as you said, exactly like some of these similarities that we like intuitively like see or understand as a researcher in the field, but then it's that it's more than just like it's the same tool or it's the same space or like these hard-coded facts. So it's like there's something about this aesthetic.
So that's, it's funny that you say so, because the reason I like it is because of the hard-coded facts.
Well, but in a different way. I mean,
yeah, maybe. See, but this metaphor may be helpful if it communicates better.
Yeah.
It certainly does. And I have to say that, you know, after listening to all that, I kind of regret not coming, because at first I thought it was going to be very technical and all about the specific software. But so we had in the discussion of first the issue of what is a connection, and, you know, you and Katarina shared the different, you know, lists, you know, which is probably endless, you know, and how much, you know, different elements might be at the root of a connection. But what's interesting here is that, you know, if you're going to understand in a more interrelational, relational, processual idea the social world, we also need a way to theorize that accordingly. Because for a long time I have been bothered that the general approach, you know, the one that you have in NVivo or Atlas TI, is like kind of this meat grinding approach to data, and you cut everything very thinly in different, you know, categories, and you put them all together. And just think of, you know, the kind of, you know, the typical way in which qualitative data and qualitative papers are written in many top tier journals, you know, like this first order code, second order codes, in which you end up losing, I think, the wholesomeness of the practice, of the social world that you experience, you know, of the activities of, you know, in the case of global insurance, what does it mean to be an underwriter? What are a set of activities that do that? And I think that Paula was referring that, you know, when she presents the data, she tries to have things like, you know, a day in the lives of, because then you can show this coherence and interconnection. So what I think you are doing, and Barbara was also doing with the idea of implotment, is always like inviting and providing the tools. Maybe your tool is more, you know, concrete, and she's more like, you know, general invitation in her case, of how we might go about, you know, slicing the data differently, you know, preserving and observing these sequences and relations.
You know, Pedro, when you talk about slicing, it reminds me of one of the things that Tim Ingold was talking about at this IFIF meeting. He had this metaphor of, he had a beautiful talk, first of all, and it was very, very poetic, actually. And one of the distinctions he made was, imagine you have a log and you can cut it either by like sawing it into sections, like cross-sectionally, or you could imagine cutting it by with an axe or a wedge, so you go with the grain like the long way. And his sense was that, you know, in social science we often do this kind of thing where we chop it cross-sectionally. Yeah. We talk about interactions and moments, and I guess that's what you're talking about, the sort of meat grinder approach. Yeah. And he felt that slicing it the long way, where you have a more natural, you know, because if you do split a piece of wood that way, it often comes out kind of wavy, right? You don't necessarily have a perfectly straight, because you're following the grain of the tree. And so a lot of people in the discussion found that very compelling and very interesting, because I think it's sort of a nice metaphor for talking about the thing you were just describing.
That's true. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. But so one of the things that was interesting in the workshop was the micro-macro thing. And if I recall correctly, wasn't that one of Demetrius's questions? He was like, how is the micro connected to the macro? And are we ever going to get this, you know, this endless, you know?
What happened to that?
Catherine, did we get an answer?
No, I think we managed to cross out micro and macro, and saying that that distinction not necessary or not for all research question makes sense. So Jennifer Howard Grenville in her talk about what are the problems in the world that we're connecting to as organizational researchers, management researchers. She presented a slide where she actually had micro-macro distinction crossed out. So that was one of the interesting things. And the other issue, which I very much liked, so we also had a discussion around, so what is a small phenomenon? What is a large phenomenon? And for some people, something is small, but for other people, that's maybe already a large phenomenon. And so, so we also crossed out that distinction, and Jennifer proposed that it might be more helpful to talk about these issues in terms of consequential. So when we talk about large issues or large phenomena, big issues, we talk about something that's very consequential for a lot of people for the world.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting.
There were kind of, you know, like people were really liking this idea of, you know, going beyond this dualism, large, small, micro, macro, and talking about consequential. I personally like, and I think this has been a common, just two things. One, I think Shatzi also, you know, have been trying to encourage dropping the idea of micro and macro and go more, you know, large and small. But about consequentiality, I think, you know, it has been done for a long time in social sciences, this idea that you go for the things that make a difference, you know, as a way to understand whether the connection is there or not. And in her case, she's pushing that further and say, you know, the things that are really consequentials are the ones that have implications to a number of things, and they are very interconnected to daily life. The only problem I would say, you know, to highlight a point I made before, is that sometimes they are invisible. You know, things like infrastructures, for instance, you know, sometimes they are consequential, but they're not apparently consequential. So again, I think it's the role and exercise of the social scientist to show that.
And the other issue, the other phenomenon that's hard to observe, but that's important when we talk about connections, is the issue of disconnecting or not being connected. Or, I mean, I think, Brian, you and I, we talked about this at the poster session about action and inaction. I mean, not acting is also an action, right? So in a sense, not connecting also has certain implications. So at one of the roundtables, we were discussing this for a long time. So how do you study? Obviously, disconnecting is important, but how do you study it?
Oh, boy. Boy, I could go on and on about that. That's, but it's because it's a really good question, and it's really hard. So what about things that never happen? You know? And I know that sounds kind of like crazy talk, but if you have, like in a social network, people that never communicate, right? So they're in different places or different, you know, that's not too surprising. In one of Barbara Czarnowska's action networks, are there actions that are really unconnected? There's no flow or relationship between them. It could be hard to observe it, but it seems like it's potentially very consequential if actions are not connected. And we had a lot of, we had this example in one of our discussions to do with, you know, global warming, big macro phenomenon. And I think legitimate to say that, you know, global climate can be changing, you know, kind of whether we think it is or not. It's not a social, I mean, there's aspects of it that are constructed discursively and so forth, but there's a sort of geological, climatological phenomenon going on. But then there's all this stuff we do, like recycling and biking versus driving and this little things we choose to do. And it's like the connections in our mind are the connections in our practice or the connections, you know, that we make versus maybe the connections that are actually there in the physical, you know, accumulation of carbon,
mm-hmm.
the physical, you know, utilization, you know, that it's, there's a lot of many, many ways that things can be connected or disconnected,
mm-hmm.
you know, layers of it.
And that actually speaks nicely to Bharat's notion of the apparatus. Sometimes it might be the apparatus that allows us to see certain things, certain connections, and others we might not see. And then when we change the way we, like the apparatus that we use to look at things, could be the simple tool, but also kind of the perspective that we take, then we suddenly see the connection. And not seeing the connection doesn't mean that it's not consequential, as you said, Brian.
Well, I'll make an example. You know, that's whole idea of should firms be managed for, and do firms have externalities or not in society? It's a whole debate. You know, should you only talk about stockholders, shareholders? You know, that's the consequence of a company to a society or a community, whatever its size is, are connected or not. You know, so when Nike decides, you know, to outsource part of the production to a place that like outsource someone else that used child labor, is there a connection there? You know, and some theories, exactly, you know, that's my point of, it's part of the job of the analyst to show something that's, it has been erased sometimes,
mm-hmm.
to show a different perspective that can put that in light, you know, that what some theories would say that, you know, it's completely independent because the company is not connected to that thing. But, you know, some other perspectives will show that actually is. So I wanted to talk of another of the dualism that we faced in the discussion, because we had this whole idea of, you know, micro and macro, which was kind of more or less abolished, I think, and there is more enlarged, and the extent it is a size issue or a consequential issue and so on and so forth. But there was also some discussions on the idea of there is such a thing as parts and wholes, you know, and I think it was something that, you know, Hari was bringing up. And I think it was interesting, actually, in the event, there was a good room for disagreements, which we sometimes we not really see, you know, in academic discussions.
Yeah, I agree that that was a very good disagreement, productive disagreement at the workshop. So I think if I remember correctly, Harry said that making part two, or making the part whole distinction is, as an, he referred to it as an ontological distinction. Also, and mm-hmm. Barbara Czerniewska kind of rejected and said, well, a priori, it doesn't make sense to make such a distinction. You go into the field and you look at what people actually do. And mm-hmm.
It's interesting. You know, it's funny. I was really struck by that conversation, because on the one hand, you know, I think Harry's point about certain kinds of things are naturally part, and other things would be considered wholes. I mean, I have a hard time getting out of that ontology. I really tend to believe that because I have a very systems theory kind of idea of understanding things. But at the same time, then I went to this other conference later, sort of the socio-materiality people. And, you know, they are big into ontology. You know, so materiality and social and humans and things, and are they inseparable or not? And there's some very strong camps in that world, and they really take it quite seriously. And I was just thinking, well, what did Barbara say again? She said it's a good idea to study ontologies. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's nice. Like, observe what people are kind of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bad idea to start with ontologies.
Yes.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, well, here's a room full of people. I'm talking like 120 smart people that were all pumped up about starting with ontologies.
Yes.
They really were. And I, you know, I didn't want to try to pick a fight with a room full of my friends, but it was like, wow, you know, these folks are working the wrong end of the game here, because it seems like it's really easy to get into making distinctions that don't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking. And so, I mean, part and whole, it's like, well, who cares if it's a part or a whole? It's just these people are doing this thing. You know, they're participating. And I suppose it, if it makes a difference, right, if it matters that these, you know, so again, in reinsurance, you know, London is not the whole market. It's not the whole world. It's part of the market. It's part of the world. And same with, you know, Bahamas, and same with any of these locations. And so, I mean, I think the story was they realized that these were parts of a whole, you know, and it's very natural, and the people involved see it that way, and it's no surprise, and, you know, it's not really controversial, I didn't think.
Well, I want to add my own disagreements, because I think I have potential to disagree with the general.
You think it is controversial? That...
Yeah, no, well, let me start with the whole idea that I kind of agree with Barbara, you know, that ontology should be what we are studying. But at the same time, I feel that she starts from a place, because when you go to the field, you have, of course, always assumptions that help you, you know, make sense and streamline what you're looking for. So I think her idea that comes from, you know, AMT is that, you know, there is a flat land. Things are interconnected. There is nothing so much of levels, but it's a matter of how they are connected to each other and how much, to what extent, and what is holding them together. Which I think that's, you know, it's fun. It's sensible, and I agree with that as well. And then, of course, I have to see how the ontologies are made, because another lesson from ANT and the whole idea of actionness that she puts forward is that actors themselves create macro actors or create the idea of large. So again, when we go into the field, these ideas already exist in part, because some actors are trying to propose, I think she had this example, you know, what happens in Gothenburg is micro or small, whereas something that happens in Stockholm, which is the capital, is large and, you know, consequential or macro, you know. There's this whole idea that there are politics being played, there are interests being played in which the way are conceptualized is, I don't know, the whole or the macro or the large, you know. It's like attaching the label of natural to something, you know. Once you put it there, you know, it becomes naturalized and hard to be, you know, seen in a different way. So I tend to think that there is only, how can I say, there are only parts, there are only, you know, situated things happening all across the world, but they are interconnected. But the point is that some of these parts are more wholesome, more macro than the others, because, for instance, what happens in the stock exchange in London might have a bigger impact because symbolic things, because the very infrastructure, you know, the fact that the newspapers are more read than the others from other places. So they have a repercussion that is different than, you know, the stock exchange in Chile, Brazil, or, you know, a smaller global south place. So I think we can, you know, in a way put to rest some of the dualism, but we must remember that they're a part in itself of the way social actors, we and, you know, people that around us, make sense of the world, you know, so they're used for specific purposes, so they become an object, you know. Does this make sense?
So, yes and no. I mean, here's the thing. Some of the idea that something that happens in one place may have a bigger impact than something in another place seems like it's a objectively testable assertion. I mean, you could see, you know, what are the consequences of actions in different places, but the idea of something being macro is more like the thing I was talking about before, the idea of all of the activities or the practices in all of these places are rhyming. Like they're all singing the same song. It's all the same fabric. It's something that you don't see when you look at one thread. Like if you look at one thread, you do not see the fabric. There's no fabric. It's just one thread. So that's each place has its own set of little set of threads. And as a field worker, your view is really even more limited than that. I mean, you can, as a person, you know, if you have a strongly phenomenological kind of view, you say, I can see one action or event at a time, and the ones that happened before, I'm just remembering, not seeing them anymore. And the ones that haven't happened yet, you know, well, they haven't happened yet. I haven't seen them at all. So I've got, you know, this very moment. It's a very Zen kind of, you know, I just have this one moment. And so everything else is a construction of some sort. Now, people are super good at narrating, or sense making would be, you know, Wyke's term, prospectively and retrospectively, to create these narrative threads to make sense out of our own experience. And field workers, we do that. But I've just got my thread, you know. Here I am in Dublin, you know, and you guys are far, far away. And so what makes something macro is the fact that those threads all over are woven in a way that creates a whole, that creates a whole. So now here I am, Tsukis, you know, parts and wholes. Each thread is a part. The fabric is the whole. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you might want to only cling to your thread.
No, I see what you mean.
But that doesn't mean it's not rhyming with, you know, or woven with a lot of other threads and a lot of other places that you just don't see.
You know? The only thing for me is that what I don't like about this distinction is that I agree, because and we learned that from, you know, since Durkheim, that, you know, social dynamics are emergent. You know, the market is made, of course, of people trading, but when everyone is trading according to specific norms, specific ways, there's like an emergent dimension that is not only the sum of the parts. But my point is that the parts are not always the same. So the threads don't have the same value, you know. So
absolutely
some,
not. Yeah, of course
so that,
not.
That is the thing. The parts, yes, we can call that they are the parts that make the whole, but some parts are more stronger, meaningful, relevant, accepted than the others. So that's the thing. See, and sometimes they go on to establish a network or microcosm of themselves, you see? So
this is where it would be great to be. I mean, yes, certainly, depending on the particular, you know, example. And this is where I have this urge to say, and, you know, like, particular cases or you know, particular kind of situations, but
and I guess that that connects with also what we discussed at the workshop, that you need to be cautious with how people, like the abstractions that people, participants in the fields, that use themselves, right? So
yes.
Saying, oh, London is really important and what they're doing in London is really important. Well, and then the market is doing all these things, but then you have to be like, so what's the market actually? And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have a critical, skeptical stance towards that stuff for sure. Yeah.
It's like, it's the idea to know, you cannot be naive and take everything that the informants tell you as the the facts, you know. So otherwise you just become trapped. Anthropologists call it become trapped in the native theories, you know, because they have their own theories about how the world functions, and then you accept that as the theory that you're going to create, you know, so you become trapped in that.
Yeah, Barbara's talk, I think she did a nice job of sort of illustrating some examples of how to avoid that. Like, don't take for granted, you know, which way things are going to break or which way things are going to move.
I wonder if you want to share what you think were like your main lessons. So we had the questions, and maybe, you know, some of them were addressed in different ways, and, you know, we learn different things sometimes. But I wonder what would be your takeaways, you know, from this conference?
Many.
Good.
Yeah. Wow. It's so interesting, you know. Because I was very, I approached it with a particular idea about connecting patterns and comparing patterns. And, you know, I think I learned one thing is, you know, I need to be more careful about how I explain these things when I'm trying to communicate what I'm talking about. But that's just a lesson for me. I mean, I think the more interesting thing in a way was this metaphor of fabric. You know, I really like that. And the idea that it's created partly by the participants, but maybe mostly by our own, theorizing and analysis. And I really thought that was a valuable idea.
For me, it was valuable to really hit home the message that you have to be very careful with the distinction that you as a researcher make when you go into the field. So don't assume something is small or something is large just because you think that might be the case. You might go in and find, actually, maybe that's not so large as I thought, or maybe something else is really large and then I need to shift my object of concern, so to speak. So, yeah, that was really a message that came home through the workshop.
I think I'll hit on that note because exactly what I learned. I was particularly, conscious because I thought initially I did not have done a multi-sided ethnography or a large-scale thing. But I studied a very large company, and I was studying like the engineering department that have something like, 4,000 people working in the development of new aircrafts. And I was like, but I feel that there is something about connections and, the fact there are different parts or, dimensions or sub-universes within this whole large process I was trying to understand. And I think the workshop gave me, the tools and the validation to continue to think about my case in those terms. Because as we're saying, Katarina, it's up for the researcher to conceptualize that in more, the parts, the whole, the large, the small, it's not self-evident, but it's you that have to show how things connect to each other and become a distributed phenomenon or not, which was a lesson, So it's about the tools that you deploy to make sense of that in those terms. And then the whole, I'm kind of sorry I didn't like learn more of Brian's stuff. I think I'm going to read up that later, but it's these ideas of, when you theorize, trying to show these connections, in the way that you're going to make sense of the data, split it and present it in ways that you can show it.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Which I think is, it's a food for thought for the next event that we might have in Zurich, how do we present these connections?
Yes, definitely I took that down, Pedro. Don't worry about this. on the future events going to happen.
Okay. So
that's cool. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate the chance to think about these things and reflect back on this whole experience, because it's been really helpful to me,
I'm glad.
A lot. For at Warwick and then here in Dublin, it's talking to people and it's very productive. So it's cool. Thank you.
So we will invite Brian to tell us more about how we can write a poem about practices.
Yeah, I'm working on it now. Actually, I already started typing. So we'll see what happens. You just have to type it in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So on the name of talking about organizations, I thank you all, Katarina and Brian, for joining us on this discussion. It was I had a lot of fun and I think it was very informative. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pedro.